Hello. Both Children's Brain Tumor Foundation and Childhood Brain Tumor Foundation are delighted to have collaborated in planning a two-part webinar series about astrocytomas for you. The second part of this informative series is entitled Astrocytoma, New Treatment Advances, and is presented by Dr. Roger Packer, Chairman of Neurology at Children's National Medical Center, Washington, D.C. Welcome to this presentation. We hope you gain new insights and knowledge about astrocytomas. Please allow us to welcome Dr. Packer and extend our deep appreciation for Dr. Packer's willingness to voluntarily dedicate his time to share his knowledge with us. Dr. Packer, thank you for joining us. Would you like to begin?
Yes, thank you for giving me this opportunity. I know that I'm the second discussant about pediatric astrocytomas, and a lot of the information about what is an astrocytoma, how it's classified, was covered by Dr. Peter Berger from Hopkins. I'm a pediatric neurologist, that's my background, from the Children's Hospital, Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., and for many years have run the brain tumor program here, both the clinical and clinical research component of the program. And the way I'm going to approach this will be to discuss this as I would discuss the issue of gliomas with any family or other person very involved in the care of a child with a glioma and an astrocytoma. I'm going to be interchanging the words glioma and astrocytoma as much as possible, because to me they just mean the same thing. An astrocytoma and a glioma is the same kind of tumor, the astrocytoma being the type of cell the tumor comes from. To put it into perspective, childhood gliomas make up over 50% of all childhood brain tumors. Many of you already know that childhood brain tumors are the second most common form of childhood cancer and the one that causes the greatest morbidity and mortality from childhood cancer. The gliomas come in a variety of different types, as Dr. Berger has talked about, and also arise in a variety of different locations. And that is why it's sort of difficult to talk about gliomas generically, because it really depends on the kind of glioma or astrocytoma you're talking about and its location to what you are going to recommend to a family and for trying to determine how you diagnose the tumor and how you deal with the family's understanding of the prognosis and what we might have to do therapeutically to improve the child's chances of survival. The gliomas in childhood can occur at any point during the childhood years. They do peak, as many childhood brain tumors, earlier in the first 5 to 10 years of life, and the lowest incidence occurs when children are at the adolescent or teenage years. In addition, some of the rarer forms of childhood gliomas are more common earlier in life. And as you move along the spectrum to older children, the gliomas tend to start becoming a little bit more like adult tumors. The one of the major differences between childhood gliomas or astrocytomas and adult tumors is the pilocytic astrocytoma. Pilocytic astrocytomas, although they occur in adults, are much more common in childhood. And as Dr. Berger probably told you earlier, the pilocytic astrocytomas are the lowest grade or the grade 1 tumors, where the other childhood lower grade tumors would be grade 2, and grades 3 and grade 4 would be held out for the more aggressive or malignant tumors. As far as what we do to make a diagnosis of the childhood brain tumor, for the vast majority of childhood brain tumors, you need a piece of tissue, either by a biopsy or a surgical resection, to make the diagnosis. Pediatric gliomas are one of the few tumors that in specific areas of the brain, especially the brainstem or possibly in the chiasm, which is the midline of the brain where the two eye nerves merge, where we would consider doing treatment without a biopsy. The neuroimaging characteristics of the tumor are so straightforward that in many of these kind of tumors, we believe that the biopsy is not necessary, may cause considerable harm, and we would start some kind of treatment without tissue confirmation. For the vast majority of other childhood low-grade tumors, including the gliomas and all of the higher-grade tumors, we would need a piece of tissue on which to determine what we're going to be doing for the child and what the likelihood of long-term disease control is. One of the major things that the biopsy tells us, especially in very young children with gliomas, is what specific type of tumor is there. And this becomes very important in a very young child because there are a tremendous amount of variation in some of the congenital tumors that look very large and may cause a lot of problems early in life, but if removed appropriately, the children do very well. And these tumors go under a variety of different names, and sometimes it's really difficult for even us to explain what this tumor is because of how strange or different the tumor cells are. Another major component of making a decision of how we're going to manage a child with an astrocytoma or a glioma is the location in the nervous system. The brain is more giving in a child in many ways, but is also more immature and more vulnerable to neurotoxic damage in other ways. And for this reason, the location becomes critical. If a glioma is arising in a deep area of brain, we're trying to remove it, would cause severe damage to the child, then we are likely to take less of the tissue. If the tumor is surgically removable and we think that it's low grade, we might be able to change prognosis significantly because by doing surgery. Also, the way that we view childhood gliomas, we don't only evaluate them on the basis of where they, what they are under the microscope, but also where they are in the nervous system. And for reasons that we don't fully understand, it seems that some gliomas and astrocytomas in childhood behave differently dependent on where they arise in the brain and the nervous system. One other factor as we look at generically at childhood astrocytomas or gliomas is that there is an effect of the condition in which the tumor arises. Most of these tumors do not have a cause. Many epidemiologic studies have been done looking for what is the real cause of a childhood astrocytoma or glioma. And for the vast majority of children, we don't know. It isn't anything the family did. If it is an exposure, we don't understand what that exposure truly is. However, there are certain conditions that make it more likely for a child to have a glioma or an astrocytoma, the most common of which is a condition called neurofibromatosis type 1, which can be inherited in families. Children with neurofibromatosis type 1 have a higher incidence of developing tumors of the nervous system, especially gliomas. Up to 20% of children with neurofibromatosis type 1 will develop a glioma at some point during their lives. The only good news about this is that these tumors tend to be relatively slow-growing. Most of them are grade 1 or pilocytic astrocytomas. And even in those children who develop those pilocytic astrocytomas, the tumors are often even more slow-growing or benign than a similar tumor in a child without neurofibromatosis type 1. The diagnosis of neurofibromatosis type 1 is still based really on clinical characteristics such as the presence of multiple brown spots on the skin called café au lait spots, lumps or bumps on the skin, development of abnormalities in the brain, which have gone by a variety of different names, but most commonly are now called focal areas of signal abnormality, and the presence of a family member with neurofibromatosis type 1. When that diagnosis is made and a tumor is found, we do often change our therapy because of the indolent nature of tumors in children with neurofibromatosis type 1. Another important factor as we try to determine what we're going to do as far as therapy for those children is that they may be more vulnerable to the deleterious effects of radiation, or other types of treatment, and we often have to modify their treatment so that the treatment we cause isn't worse than the underlying problem they have. Another condition which is rarer but is increasingly diagnosed is a condition called tuberous sclerosis. This is a condition where children develop premature acne on the skin called adenoma sebaceum. They may have a variety of different problems, both in the heart and the kidneys, and many, but not all of the children, have significant developmental delays. These children are prone to develop a certain kind of tumor deep in the brain, which for many years have been called a giant cell astrocytoma. There's a lot of argument of whether they're truly astrocytomas or maybe mixed neuronal and glial or astrocytic tumors. But in any event, that's a different kind of tumor. Again, these tumors tend to be very indolent. Many children have these kind of tumors with tuberous sclerosis and never need any treatment. The main thing that these tumors do is they arise deep in the brain, and because they arise deep in the brain, they often block off cerebrospinal fluid when they grow and develop a hydrocephalus, which is excess water on the brain. Given all of what we do or don't know about childhood gliomas, the biology of these tumors is going to be critical in the way we manage them in the future. Remarkably, though we have all these new techniques and science has made tremendous breakthroughs, we still have a lot to learn about the biology of childhood gliomas. For the lowest grade tumor, the pilocytic astrocytoma, until recently, very little was known about the biology. We knew that many of these tumors were congenital, others would develop very early in life, and that they would grow slowly or have an erratic growth rate. However, what was controlling their growth rate, why these tumors acted so benignly while other gliomas do not, and why some pilocytic astrocytomas are not as benign and will spread and grow quickly, were things that were completely not understood. At this point, our understanding of them has gotten a little bit better. We know that these pediatric pilocytic astrocytomas often have specific biochemical pathways that are activated, predominantly molecular genetic pathways, which gives us a possibility to try to treat them with agents directly designed to disrupt those pathways. Work is now ongoing at our institution and others around the country, supported predominantly by foundations who are focused on pilocytic astrocytomas, looking for some of these new approaches to treatment based on the biology of the tumor. We know that many of these tumors express specific markers, especially epidermal growth factor receptor, on their surface that may be a target. We also know that some of these tumors actually have a certain mechanism working that they are overregulating a pathway which is involved in the mTOR pathway, and this is another target for treatment. As we get into the other kinds of childhood gliomas and talk about their biology, we do run into significant issues about whether these tumors are the same or different than adult gliomas. It is often said that adults with low-grade tumors are only adults with low-grade tumors for a short period of time, and that the majority of these tumors will mutate over a 3 to 5 year period into a higher-grade tumor. We know in the pediatric ages, children with low-grade tumors usually stay low-grade, especially through the pediatric years. And that holds not only for the grade 1 or pilocytic astrocytomas, but also for the majority of the grade 2 tumors. Why childhood grade 2 tumors stay low-grade while adults progress to high-grade are one of the things that remains unknown. In addition, there has been information which has been not fully substantiated, but information that leads you to believe that childhood high-grade tumors are also different than adult high-grade tumors. Although the prognosis for childhood high-grade tumors is not good, and many of those tumors will progress and take the life of the child, some children with high-grade tumors do survive, especially those with the anaplastic or grade 3 tumors. This is unfortunately not the case in adults, where most of these tumors will progress. Work by a variety of investigators around the country have started to disclose that even there are differences between childhood high-grade and low-grade tumors, that the biologic receptors and things that seem to be controlling growth for childhood low-grade tumors seem somewhat different than the higher-grade tumors, where adults often have a great deal of amplification of a growth factor called epidermal growth factor receptor on the cell surface. Childhood brain tumors do not usually have those amplified, even if they're high-grade tumors. Other mechanisms, which are called downstream mechanisms, which are involved molecular genetically in cell replication, such as the P10, that's a capital P-T-E-N mutation, which occurs very frequently in adults with malignant gliomas, occurs very infrequently in children with malignant gliomas. That may be one of the reasons that the childhood high-grade tumors do a bit better. It may also tell us a tremendous amount about how we should be approaching these tumors in the future, because treating them with adult approaches may not be appropriate. Going from the biology to how we make the diagnosis of these tumors, the major symptoms and signs of the tumors are dependent on not only the location of the tumor in the nervous system, which is the primary criteria, but also is based on how fast the tumor is growing. High-grade tumors that grow quickly, such as the high-grade gliomas, are more likely to cause headaches and very specific neurologic deficits in a child, while as lower-grade tumors may be more insidious, grow much slower, cause less in the way of acute problems such as headaches, and may more likely cause generalized slowing in the child, loss of developmental milestones, and especially in specific in areas such as the temporal lobe and the frontal lobe, seizures. When we have the appropriate signs and symptoms, the next step is to try to image whether a child does or doesn't have a brain tumor. And the way to make that diagnosis in the vast majority of the children is with an MRI scan. This is the most specific way of making the diagnosis. However, because of availability, most institutions would probably do a CT scan first, especially if the child is coming through the emergency room, which, if done with and without dye, has nearly a 98% sensitivity of picking up the tumor, but is not as good as an MRI in telling us how large the tumor is and what part of the nervous system it involves. For that, you need an MRI scan, and that is the critical element now for the diagnosis of these tumors. With an MRI scan, it's nearly 100% sensitivity in picking up the tumor. The MRI scan, just as the CAT scan, can often give us clues on what kind of tumor is present, but it does not replace, in the most cases, the need for a biopsy. As regards specific or non-specific things that gliomas cause, I think what bothers families tremendously is, first of all, when a child has a headache, could this underlie a brain tumor? The reality is that headaches are very common in children and brain tumors are very rare. The majority of headaches are absolutely not related to any kind of brain tumor or any problems with growth in the brain. However, this is always the issue that families raise. And as a neurologist, the things that we use to try to determine who is at risk for a brain tumor if they have headaches are headaches that are actually brand new, that the child didn't have a very long history of these kind of headaches. Headaches, even if they've had a long history of changed patterns, headaches that are associated with nausea or vomiting, or headaches that can awaken a child from sleep. The one problem with using those criteria is that migraine can do about all of that. So it is sometimes difficult to separate out the likelihood that the child has a migraine type of problem or has some kind of a growth. If those nuances are there, such as a headache that occurs in the middle of the night or headaches which occur first thing in the morning associated with nausea and vomiting, I think that most neurologists or pediatricians would do a CAT scan or an MRI scan early. If those things are not present and the neurologic examination is otherwise normal, it's sort of difficult to determine whether it is worth putting a child through a neuroimage. One of the major drawbacks of neuroimaging is if you use a CAT scan, it is radiation exposure, and we don't like exposing young children to radiation. However, in a very young child, a CAT scan is much faster, and to do an MRI in a young child requires significant sedation, often with an anesthesiologist at the child's side. So those are some of the reasons that we don't want to put every child through a CAT scan or an MRI scan. But if the situation arises, that's the way to make the diagnosis. Other symptoms that are fairly non-specific or non-localizing that tells us that there's maybe an underlying problem would include these headaches associated with nausea and vomiting, which could be either due to the tumor causing pressure or the tumor blocking off cerebrospinal fluid and causing hydrocephalus or fluid on the brain. Once again, these headaches tend to worsen over time, tend to be associated with nausea and vomiting. Other symptoms which are not particularly helpful in localizing but gives us a warning is that if a child slows down in school, there is a slowdown in the child's development. A very rare but a syndrome that we sometimes see is that there is a growth in the middle of the brain that does not allow the child to gain weight despite eating apparently quite well, and that's called a diencephalic syndrome. Most of the other symptoms we have are really more related to exactly where the tumor is. Tumors which come and arise in the lower part of the brain, called the brainstem and cerebellum, cause either balance problems or problems with eye movements or other cranial nerve problems. The tempo of the onset of those kind of problems is often a very good clue when problems have been happening very slowly. They tend to be caused by things like low-grade tumors that occur in the cerebellum, which will start by having some balance problems in an arm and a leg, and then secondarily move to cause blockage of spinal fluid and then more acute problems such as headaches. When the problems arise relatively quickly, and especially when there's crossing of the eyes and weakness of the face or swallowing difficulties, we're very worried that there is a growth within the brain stem, predominantly called a brainstem glioma, which we'll talk about later. As regards tumors that are in different locations, if there's problems with vision, we are very worried that there's a tumor either behind the eye or if the child's visual field is abnormal, meaning that there is a lack of peripheral vision or, for that matter, nasal vision, then we're very worried that the area behind the eye nerves called the chiasm could be involved with a chiasmatic glioma. And when the tumor is higher up in the brain, usually we will either see weakness or other kinds of problems if the tumor involves the motor system, maybe sensory problems, numbness if it involves the sensory system. But if it's low or slow growing, one of the more common things that we see is seizures, and those seizures can be there for many years at times before we make a diagnosis of a brain tumor. At this point, what I'd like to then do is move and talk about specific tumors, how we are treating them now, and how we may be treating them in the future. The most common form of childhood glioma is a low-grade astrocytoma that arises in the cerebellum, which is the lowest and back portion of the brain. The cerebellum acts such like a little computer in the back of the brain that controls a balance Usually the symptoms are that the child has balance difficulties in one arm or one leg, and then later as the tumor comes more towards the middle of the brain, may cause hydrocephalus and more headaches and more problems with what we call truncal unsteadiness or sitting, or more problems with just being able to walk and stumbling all over the place. The vast majority of childhood cerebellar astrocytomas are low grade. They have a very characteristic MRI where there's a solid component and a cyst around it. Usually, by looking at the MRI, we can make a pretty good judgment that that tumor is going to be a low-grade cerebellar astrocytoma. The treatment for those tumors is to remove it. If the tumor is completely removed, 95 to 100% of the children will be cured of their disease and will require no other treatment such as radiation or chemotherapy, and all they will need is follow-up MRI scans to be sure that the tumor hasn't come back. Occasionally, this tumor is closer to the middle of the brain, in the back of the brain, and because of that, it may be more difficult to remove. Occasionally, it's more solid, and some of those solid cerebellar astrocytomas are more likely to be a little bit more aggressive. They may be not only grade 1 tumors, but some of them are true grade 2s. But if it's totally removed, we would still watch the tumor and only use radiation or chemotherapy if the tumor activated. Sometimes these tumors are so indolent or slow-growing that after the surgeon removes a component of the tumor, we would elect not to treat it but just watch it and only have the surgeon come back and try to remove it again if it starts to grow again. Usually when these tumors are left behind, they will grow and ultimately will need to be removed, but it may take months or years before we have to do that. However, what we do like to see, if possible, and especially if the tumor is in the right location in the cerebellum, for it to be fully removed. The higher grade or grade 2 or grade 3 tumors in that area are more problematic, and occasionally they will require radiation or chemotherapy. One of the concerns about asking the surgeon to remove the tumor is that despite all of the wonderful techniques they have, there is some cutting into the normal brain, especially if the tumor is in the middle, and that may cause a disruption of some fibers that are critical for brain development. One thing we are seeing more, unfortunately, as surgeons try to remove the more deep-seated or larger midline tumors, is an entity called the posterior fossa mutism syndrome, even in cerebellar astrocytomas, where the children seem to initially awake after surgery and 12 to 24 hours later, or even earlier than that, seem to become mute. It becomes clear that the child has a lot of language difficulties, is a very abnormal speech even when the speech comes back, and has a lot of other problems with balance and often emotional control and other problems in the nervous system. And about half of these children, this syndrome will get better over the next few weeks, and in about half we will have permanent sequelae. It probably complicates 5% of all cerebellar astrocytoma surgeries, or maybe even a little bit less than that. The second kind of tumor that occurs in the posterior fossa, and one of the worst tumors we have to face, is the brainstem glioma. This is a tumor that, unlike a cerebellar astrocytoma or a pilocytic astrocytoma that acts as a ball and pushes the normal brain away, is a tumor that infiltrates the brainstem and sort of seeps within the brainstem. And often these children present with an eye turning in or their face not moving as well on one side, possibly with swallowing difficulties, possibly with weakness or unsteadiness from one side of the body. And then when you do the MRI, you see a diffusely swollen brainstem, especially in the most middle part of the brainstem called the pons. Because of the location of the tumor, the majority of children with diffuse enlargement of the pons are treated without a biopsy. When biopsies have been done for brainstem gliomas, about one-third of the children after the biopsy are significantly worse, and another third of the children, the tissue that's removed, because you can only remove so little, will result in no diagnosis being made under the microscope. Even in some children where we take out the biopsy and find out it's a grade 2 tumor, the tumor will act much more aggressively and ultimately will show itself to be a higher or grade 3 or grade 4 tumor. It's a very difficult tumor to treat. These children are usually quite ill at the time they're diagnosed. They can't be treated with surgery. About a fifth of them will require shunt to remove cerebrospinal fluid because of hydrocephalus. Though we have tried many things over the past two decades for brainstem gliomas, for the majority of children, this tumor will take their lives in 9 to 18 months of diagnosis. This is despite treatment with radiation and chemotherapy. Even saying that there is a small subgroup of children who the radiation and chemotherapy or radiation alone can result in long-term disease control and possibly cure. And since we can't easily select out which patients are going to do badly from those few that are going to do well, I certainly have recommended that all children with brainstem gliomas undergo at least radiation therapy to try to control the tumor growth. We have tried making radiation more effective by increasing the dose, by giving the radiation twice a day, by using a lot of chemotherapy before and after radiation, and to date, nothing has worked better than radiation. Saying that radiation does result in improvement in almost 90% of children with either shrinkage or stabilization of the tumor, and clinical improvement with symptoms getting better, but then the tumor coming back with a vengeance soon thereafter. Right now, one of the things that we are trying is we're taking a look at newer therapies, is trying to add either chemotherapy or new biologic agents with radiation for patients. We've yet to show that that has improved their survival, but there's good rationale, especially biologic rationale, for using some of the newer biologic agents that may be attacking the molecular mechanism of the tumor and coupling that with radiation and making radiation more effective. Unfortunately, to date, using higher dose chemotherapy or other things before or after radiation haven't worked out as well. Our feeling is that if you use some of these agents during radiation, often you should go ahead and continue them afterwards. There is no standard chemotherapy to add to radiation. I know that a lot of people around the country are using a drug called temozolomide for brainstem gliomas, but there is no proof that it will improve survival. A couple of caveats about brainstem gliomas are that not all brainstem gliomas are the diffuse intrinsic. There are some tumors that arise lower in the brain that are true polycytic astrocytomas. Those are the cervical medullary tumors. And those tumors may be treated quite well with surgery alone, or if the tumor is too embedded in the brain stem, the lower part of the brain stem, surgery followed by either radiation or chemotherapy. We would certainly use chemotherapy in very young children with low-grade cervical medullary tumors. For the there is another type of brainstem tumor called a tectal tumor. This is a tumor that arises high in the brainstem, again, going outside of the brainstem, moving back from the top portion of the brainstem. And many of these children just present with hydrocephalus or fluid on the brain. And many of these children are treated well just by draining the fluid, either with a shunt or a third ventriculostomy, and almost three-fourths of the children don't require any other treatment for years other than fluid drainage. One of the other caveats is that sometimes intrinsic tumors may not be as diffuse and may be very localized, and occasionally there is a more focal cystic tumor in the brain stem, which is a true polycytic astrocytoma, which might be treated best with surgical drainage or partial surgical removal and radiation or chemotherapy. We don't know a lot about the biology of brainstem gliomas, especially the diffuse intrinsic. In time, if taking a piece of the tumor will change how we're going to treat the tumor, because we're going to use the information to give some families one type of therapy that may be biologically based versus not giving that kind of therapy to another family, that certainly may be a reason to biopsy the patients. My recommendation for most families with brainstem gliomas, especially diffuse intrinsic, is to find out from major centers around the country what is available as far as investigational agents. They may or may not help the child, but given the dire prognosis, I think it is worth looking into those newer kinds of approaches, biologic or chemotherapy during radiation, to see if we can improve survival and improve the quality of life of these children. Moving up the brain, the next most common place where children get brain tumors is in the diencephalon or in the chiasmatic area. These are the tumors that are more frequent in children with neurofibromatosis. These are the tumors that can be very difficult to diagnose early in life. They may result in a child having some delay in development. They may present, if the tumor is a little bit above the chiasm where the optic nerves meet, with failure to thrive, with a child not being able to gain weight, despite apparently seeming neurologically normal and having some degree of an appetite. And those children may have massive growths in the middle of the brain, which are hypothalamic gliomas, and have very little in the way of other symptoms other than failure to thrive. That's why these children with this kind of condition have been labeled as children having the diencephalic syndrome. The treatment for chiasmatic gliomas is dependent on what kind of symptoms the tumor is causing. Is the tumor only in the chiasm, or is it sticking out to the side where it's more surgically amenable, and whether the child does or does not have neurofibromatosis type 1. Although the children with neurofibromatosis type 1 often also have optic nerve involvement, and this is less frequent in the children without neurofibromatosis type 1, both patterns can be seen in both types of children. For the majority of children with neurofibromatosis type 1, no biopsy is needed. These patients are going to have low-grade tumors, usually pilocytic astrocytomas. In the children without neurofibromatosis type 1, for years what we have recommended was biopsy to be sure that we aren't missing a different kind of tumor. That remains a somewhat controversial recommendation. Some children are treated without a biopsy. Some children do get biopsied, especially those that look somewhat atypical. Once we know it is a chiasmatic glioma, the vast majority are low grade, either grade 1 or grade 2. In children with neurofibromatosis type 1, if this tumor is not causing problems, or at least is not causing new problems, we are often elect to watch it. This is especially true for those tumors of the visual pathway that involve one or both optic nerves. If the children may have no clear-cut progressive symptoms, or for that matter have no symptoms, they may just be watched with sequential MRI scans. On the other hand, the vast majority of children without neurofibromatosis type 1 and visual pathway or chiasmatic gliomas or hypothalamic gliomas will require some kind of treatment period. Although these tumors may be low grade and slow growing, they will usually cause problems with decreasing vision, possibly going into the hypothalamic area and causing hormonal problems. And for these patients, treatment has to be tailored exactly for the size of the tumor and the age of the patient. There are studies presently underway or have just been completed looking at the relative values of different kinds of chemotherapies for these tumors. The most common chemotherapy that has been used has been a combination of carboplatin and vincristin. This type of chemotherapy will result in tumor shrinkage or at least stabilization in up to 90% of patients, with two-thirds of patients having true shrinkage. This is especially used in the very young child because we want to stay away from radiation because of the potential detrimental effects of radiation on the surrounding brain and ultimately cognition. The experience with chemotherapy is that, again, it works in the majority of patients to at least delay the need for radiation. In about two-thirds of the patients where it seems to work, they will ultimately need some other form of treatment, either further chemotherapy or possibly radiation therapy. When they get older, usually they get at least 3 years from about a year's worth of chemotherapy, but that is variable. For the older patients, it's controversial of what you do first. Although chemotherapy may indeed work, if it's only going to work for a short period of time, the question is always arises, would you be better off in just giving this child radiation? Radiation does work well. It causes disease stabilization or shrinkage in 90 to 95% of patients. It has probably a longer-term benefit, but the risks of radiation are always those of what is the long-term problems related with the with radiation as far as radiation-induced secondary tumors, radiation-induced blood vessel damage and strokes, and radiation-induced problems with brain development and cognitive development. Also in this region, because of how the radiation is given, it can cause significant permanent endocrinologic problems. So for all of those reasons, treatment really has to be tailored to the conditions that are associated, such as neurofibromatosis, the age of the child, and the extent of the tumor. Surgery has a small role in diencephalic tumors. Sometimes when there's a large cyst, the cyst needs to be removed. Sometimes you need to do it for biopsy reasons to make a correct diagnosis. Moving again up the brain to other areas in the brain, the cortical or low-grade tumors and high-grade tumors of the cerebral cortex are a hard tumor to just summarize because they occur in various different areas of the brain, and the symptoms they are going to cause will be very dependent on where they arise in the brain. If they occur in the front part of the brain or in the temporal lobes, they may be very silent for a long period of time because those areas are more involved with higher cortical function, executive functioning, and it may be difficult to pick up the problems. If they occur in the back of the cortex and the occipital lobe, although in older patients it may be easy to know that they're there, in younger children who can't tell you exactly how they see or don't see things, it may be difficult to make an early diagnosis. For tumors that arise near the middle of the cortex or the top part of the brain, they're lying near the motor areas, there the diagnosis is easier because they usually cause problems that are more evident and more easy to find because there's weakness on the side of the body contralateral to the lesion. As regards treatment, for the vast majority, the first treatment is going to try to remove as much of the tumor as possible, and it's been shown both in the low grades and the high grades that removing more of the tumor improves the likelihood of long-term disease control. The problem with this is that some of these tumors do arise in very eloquent areas of the brain and may be difficult to remove. In older patients, you might even want to try to do the surgery with the child awake, which sounds barbaric but could be done. However, there are new techniques such as functional MRI scanning where you can see actual function on the MRI of an area to localize language or motor functions that give the surgeon a better idea of what he can safely remove and cannot safely remove. As we talked about earlier, often these low-grade tumors may present with seizures, and the only problem the child has is seizures. And with the increased use of surgery to remove the seizure focus, we are sometimes finding tumors in areas that we just thought were dysplastic or just abnormally organized brain. In low-grade tumors, if the tumor can be totally removed and the tumor is a grade 1 and possibly a grade 2 tumor, most investigators would recommend no treatment and just observation. In partially resected tumors, it's somewhat controversial, but most would recommend a period of observation before instituting treatment, and that treatment might either be radiation or chemotherapy, dependent on the age of the child or the size of the growth. Others would recommend immediate radiation, especially if only a small portion of the tumor was removed. A recent nationwide study suggested that the majority of partially removed tumors will come back, especially if they're grade 2 tumors, but that coming back may take months to years, and there'll still be a subgroup, up to 30 to 40%, that over a 3 to 5 year period will not start to grow again, even if partially resected. There's little known about alternative treatments for those kind of low-grade tumors, although there's a lot of work being done. There is a variety of low-grade tumor called the oligodendroglioma, which does arise in children, but arises less frequently than it does in adults. And that tumor, especially if it has a specific genetic aberrations called a 1p19q abnormality, may be very sensitive to chemotherapy, allowing us to delay radiation. And drugs that have been used have included drugs such as temozolomide or the combination of procarbazine, CCNU, and vincristine. For the higher grade tumors, treatment is quite problematic. We do like to see as much of the tumor removed as possible. That does give us the best opportunity to treat the child. The majority of children with higher grade tumors, even if the tumor is completely removed, and many of them cannot be completely removed, and even when it is completely removed, we're often worried that there is a little bit left behind microscopically, will require treatment with radiation and chemotherapy. The standard of treatment now in the United States and probably around the world for adults with high-grade tumors is local radiation therapy to the primary tumor site with a margin of 1 to 2 centimeters with concomitant chemotherapy with a drug called temozolomide during and after radiation. This type of drug has an approach has not been proven yet to be the standard of care for children. Unfortunately, for the majority of children, other than radiation, there isn't a standard of care. This is the type of tumor, again, that we're trying to look very carefully at the biology of the tumor to see if there are clues of specific biologic agents we can use to attack the receptors, especially the growth receptors on the surface of the tumor, or the machinery within the tumor. There are other new approaches that are being looked at for this tumor. One that the adults use, which has not gained wide acceptance in children and has never been truly proven to be safe or effective in children, is to put wafers on the inner surface of the tumor after resection, and these wafers contain a chemotherapy that sifts into the brain, and this is called a Liadel wafer. Another approach which we are exploring and others have been exploring are to actually put catheters around the rim of the tumor and infuse either biologic agents or chemotherapeutic agents or poisons in these catheters, and that these catheters would allow things to drip in slowly in the brain because they're hooked to a system where the medication is not given in one bolus but is put in slowly over 48 to 96 hours. And this is something called convection delivery, allowing the brain's interstitial fluid to carry this to different areas of the brain around the tumor. Another approach that was looked at very hard in the past and will now be looked at again is the issue of gene therapy, whether in the rim of the tumor we can put in gene products, usually carried by viruses, that could affect the cell and make the cell die either directly or by giving some kind of a suicide message to the cell and then coming back with some kind of an agent that the cell would recognize it was infected by this virus and then would die. These approaches had partial effectiveness, but were not truly proven to be effective, but they are being looked at with new modern technology. Unfortunately, for the high-grade tumors in children, the outcome is not uniformly good for the grade 3 or anaplastic tumors. Even with all of these therapies, we are looking at probably no more than about 40% of the children being diagnosed with this tumor being alive and free of disease 5 years from diagnosis, even less when the tumor cannot be fully removed or when the therapy has to be limited because of the age of the child or other problems. For children with a grade four tumor, the glioblastoma multiforme, we again think that this tumor is somewhat different than the adult, but unfortunately, the majority of the children with this tumor will die. There is a subgroup that do survive, especially those who have tumors that are amenable to extensive resections, and a lot of work is being done to try to improve survival for these patients. In the last couple of minutes, I do want to mention the issue of infant gliomas, especially infant high-grade gliomas. Infant gliomas, although that can be very damaging and be very large at the time of diagnosis, may at times be more responsive to chemotherapy than adult or older children malignant gliomas. And this is something that's being explored right now to see if they are biologically different. That's one of the reasons we don't want to give up on a child at any time, but especially a young child with an aggressive tumor, because they may be more responsive to chemotherapy than we initially would have guessed by just looking under the microscope. A second is that young children often have very strange tumors. A variety of different names are used, such as desmoplastic infantile ganglioglioma or glioma, dysembryoplastic neuroepithelial tumor or a DNET, and even rarer tumors such as astroblastoma. These tumors are hard to classify. They're hard also to give a prognosis to, because many of those tumors, although very large at the time of diagnosis, really are congenital tumors, and if they can be removed, sometimes even partially, will act very benignly for many years and maybe forever. So we never want to give up on an infant because of that variability of outcome. The last thing we do want to mention is that clearly, although one of our major goals, or the major goal, is to cure the child of the tumor, we are always cognizant that the brain is developing. And there are long-term effects of the tumor, its surgery, and its treatment, especially radiation, on brain development. Children with these types of tumors need to be very carefully monitored for many years. They have to be monitored for possibility of tumor recurrence, but they also have to be monitored for these possible sequelae, and this kind of care, as probably almost all the care, should be delivered at centers that really have specialized expertise and ability in these brain tumors. Parents should be informed consumers. They need to know what is available at the center where the child is diagnosed and what is available elsewhere. They are often in a very rough situation in that it's important to gather information, but it's also important to do therapy quickly before the tumor takes too much of a toll, and you can't delay too long waiting to make a decision on therapy, and that's always the bind we put in families. We also, I think, a major concept is that often the best treatment for a child with a benign or malignant glioma is to be part of an investigational or clinical trial. In the vast majority of cases, families will get therapy, which is at least the standard of care, and often these newer approaches, if they're explained appropriately, have great promise, not only for the child, but for future generations of children who have these problems. And for this reason, they certainly should be looked at carefully. Nobody wants to use a child as a guinea pig. Nobody wants to, at any point, not offer the child the best in care just to do a study or to do another investigation. But for the vast majority of children, these studies will both allow the family to give the child the best in care and also possibly to find new ways to treat the tumor that will be more effective for not only that child, but for other children who may develop such tumors later in life. There are a variety of centers that can deliver this care. There are a variety of organizations, such as the Pediatric Brain Tumor Consortium and the Children's Oncology Group, that coordinate the center, those kind of studies. And there are institutional studies, and parents should take advantage of that for their children. I'm sure I did not cover all the things you wanted to hear, but in about a 55 minute, this is the best we can do, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with all of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Packer, for sharing such a critical and thought-provoking presentation. You have provided such invaluable information for all of us. Both Children's Brain Tumor Foundation and Childhood Brain Tumor Foundation appreciate that you have joined us for our webinar presenting Astrocytoma New Treatment Advances. We hope this companion series has been informative and has answered some questions you may have had. Please be sure to listen to Dr. Berger's presentation if you have not. Both Dr. Berger and Dr. Packer, dedicated experts, have generously volunteered their time to enable us to bring this webinar to you. Thank you. This concludes our webinar series about astrocytomas.
Thank you. Hello, is anybody...